So for those of you who weren't here last time, we're doing a 2-week series on ethics in terms of the five precepts. I'm going to do a tiny review and then go ahead. And the five precepts, as many of you know, it's the five ethical guidelines for training in ethical behavior for lay people. So not monks. They have a huge list. Five people. We lay people only five. And it's, oddly correspondent to some aspects of the Ten Commandments. Sacred people seem to come up with some of the same stuff. And so we talked last time about not killing, training in. It's always like you say, training in, not killing, because it's not an absolute. It's a training, it's a practice. But training and not killing, training and not lying, training and not stealing is what we did last time. And this time we're doing training in avoiding sexual misconduct and training in avoiding abuse of intoxicants. And these two are trickier in a lot of ways, but we'll explore. But just to get back, so the Buddha was real clear. Sometimes people think, oh, this ethics stuff is kind of basic, the whole basic dissing because it's basic thing, or it's, but it actually is really core. You just can't do this practice without ethics being clean, and then as we practice, the whole sense of ethical conduct becomes more refined and more nuanced. It grows with us, and it completely supports our practice. And the Buddha was real clear that without clear ethical conduct, the goal of the path, nibbana, can't happen. In the Numerical Discourses, 8.29, he says, just as Visakha, whatever is accomplished by an unvirtuous person is completely unproductive, I say the same regarding nibbana. Whatever is accomplished by an unvirtuous person does not lead to nibbana. So this is really part of our journey to awakening, cannot be separated. Very just incredibly important because, in practice, when we, and I really appreciated several different people were talking about bringing practice into their lives, not just on the cushion, but the whole thing. And when we bring our practice into our conduct with people, we get to test constantly in terms of the choices we make or want to make or resist making, how the ethical basis of what we're doing. And we can see how that generous choices brighten the mind, and selfish choices, unethical choices, darken the mind. It's just clear as a bell. And since we're on the journey to awakening, we want to go bright, not dark. Quote I always use, the mind is luminous, obscured by visiting defilements, but you can see how, looking at it that way, that visiting defilements are the core problem. Otherwise, mind is luminous, and we could rest in that. But we're obscured. We don't see it because of visiting defilements, perhaps from our long checkered lives, perhaps from other lifetimes, but also from micro choices we've been making, over our lives recently. Those are defilements that we place right in our minds if we want to, if we make unethical choices. Not because there's some, sacred tablet upon which they're inscribed, but just because of how it works in the energy. We'll explore that a little more. But the good news is they're visiting, so we can kick visitors out, right? We can kick visitors out and cultivate good ethical behavior. And I really think that there's really a tangible darkening that happens when we choose something unethical. We can just feel it color the mind a little bit. And so those actions of body, speech and mind, any of those things really colors our whole way. And it's almost like a catch-22 to try to do practice if we're behaving unethically. And another way of seeing that darkening is concretization of self, because much of ethical practice has to do with whether or not we're putting ourselves ahead of someone else or lying in order to get something we wanted from someone else, all of those things, stealing from someone else, so and killing someone else. You know, there's usually some sense of one getting something for oneself in over someone else, and that is a concretization of self right there. It just chunks. You can feel the energy just tighten up. Your self identity just tightens up. And again, that's the opposite direction that we want to be going in practice, where we're letting go, seeing through this illusory self-identity. And a key overall is intention, because the actions we do to some degree, depending on the condition, can or cannot be obviously ethical or unethical, but intention can make all the difference. Where I was saying last time, you know, someone with a blade cuts someone open, and if that person's a murderer, that's unethical. If that person's a heart surgeon, you know, Doctors Without Borders trying to save someone's life, just the opposite. So it's really intention is right at the basis of that. And then you can really see in terms of coloring the mind, it totally makes sense, right? Where we're at in our intention, our heart, and how this works with us. So in terms of what we talked about last time, as I was saying, the three precepts of training and not stealing, training and not killing, and training and not lying, they're all more straightforward, because we kind of know that. People know that in many cultures, you don't do those things. And it's real clear in all those situations. It's pretty black and white. You know, if you take something that's not freely offered, you're taking it. So it's not so hard to figure out how to navigate those things. It can be hard to make the choices because we're pulled in some other direction. But usually it's a fairly bright line about what to do or not. Now, you know, the killing thing is hard because it's pretty hard to navigate life at all without killing something. If you're gardening, you're killing things, you know, even if you don't want to. And, you know, if those of us who eat meat, or at any point, someone's dying on our behalf, and all of those. So intention's important, and we have to navigate that one carefully, depending on what we feel. And there's, I mean, even among Buddhist monastics, there's a whole range of different positions people take on. You know, I was in Thailand, and I was two monasteries, one monastery that was vegetarian, two that weren't, you know, relatively close to each other, all in Thailand, all very culturally appropriate Thai monasteries. Dalai Lama, sometimes he says he's a vegetarian half the time, because his doctors told him he should eat some meat, so he does, but consciously doesn't half the time. So, you know, people navigate that in all kinds of ways. But the remaining two are complex. And I got to say, this is one of the harder things I've tried to work on. And if I'll be interested in feedback, and because it's tricky, you know, they're very nuanced in how we navigate these and the choices we make about what's sexual misconduct and what isn't, or what is abusing intoxicating substances or not. That is hard for us in our culture as lay people. So I'm going to introduce some ways of looking at it. But let me say that in monastic world, because some of us go to Clear Mountain, and that's sort of the kind of the bright line of, in monastic world, if you breach the ethical boundary of sexual misconduct, you're not a monk. Just like that, you know, in the story. It doesn't mean, I'm sure, I think you can come back in, I'm not sure, but you've just unmonked yourself. And they just don't drink, zero alcohol, not happening at all. You know, I mean, I know a lot of lay people who are very serious practitioners and might have a glass of wine. I'm not one of those, but I know people do. Then you have to judge, is it clouding, is it intoxicating in terms of one's practice, in terms of what one is trying to do, is it helpful or not? It's a blurry line. It's not, so it's a training. It's not an ethical, you know, bright line of right and wrong. Kind of what makes sense. And in Tibetan practice, there's There's something called a suk practice where you do offerings to Padmasambhava, a big elaborate food offering and a whole liturgy about it, which includes eating meat and drinking wine as part of that practice. So, I mean, I've been around suk practices where they were, some people were drinking too much wine or something, but it is, you know, so there you go. You know, it's not rigid. But what really counts is what, you know, how we look at our practice, our journey toward freedom, and how we maneuver through these various aspects in ways that are helpful. And so kind of getting a sense of what boundary lines can be and how it works can be helpful in the choices we make, because as lay people, it's going to be complicated. And some areas that seem significant is that one thing about these two activities, sexuality and taking intoxicants, is in a way, they're personal activities which aren't inherently at the expense of others. You know, the sexual thing's obviously very complicated, but if you're stealing something, that's black and white. It's at the expense of others. If you're lying to someone, that's at the expense of others. But sexuality, you know, can be between, say, I'm already in a hot water. You can be between adults. People do stuff with themselves, you know, all those things. So it's an experience that people do, not in the same black and white. And as for intoxicants, you know, people do that all kinds of different ways. People get drink in closets, you know, people, they go to bars, they do all kinds of stuff. And then, of course, now things that are unfathomable to me, that you can go out and buy, not that I do it, but you can go out and buy marijuana just down the street, which was, you know, I remember driving through Las Vegas back in the 60s, and if you had a found with anything, you bam, be in jail. And now it's like totally changed. So, you know, that part's kind of relative. And also these actions, sexuality is, and in a different way, some mind-altering substances are part of, for some people, very rich explorations as human beings. So how you fit that in with the Dharma is an open matter, something to really look into individually. It is not going to get any black and white answers from either from Buddhist teachers, or because even within the world of Buddhism, it's these things look really different. And then our discernment about this, I mean, there's all kinds of political and cultural norms out there in different countries that make this really complicated in terms of how we negotiate, how we nuance through these worlds. And then there's a whole, lastly, just the whole arena of the ways in which these actions can be inherently pleasurable or enjoyable, and how you navigate that, to what degree we can experience something that's pleasurable and cling or not cling, and how we can do that. You know, Dalai Lama can eat an ice cream, he's not clinging. But it can be very difficult to participate in either of these things for some of us some of the time and not cling in some way. So that's kind of really the kind of the core question there, is it helping us awaken to be free or not? So a little bit of exploration. Yeah, the personal actions part, you know, I mean, in a sense, people who are doing substances as a private matter, except we all know that that affects people around them in all kinds of ways. So it's a blurry line. And that's something that, you know, people doing 12-step work have to really wake up to the effects they had on others and make amends and all of that stuff. So we just need to pay attention to it. It's not a rigid line, but there may be some times when someone does something completely privately, and I guess it has no effect on someone else, but it would have effect on their ability to see clearly. And the same with sexual activity, and that gets, you know, obviously very, even in a consensual thing, it gets really complicated about who might be in some kind of position energetically with someone else, all of that, not to mention if it's not all that consensual, or if there's any kind of power issues going on. Very complicated. So any kind of way that people do either of these things, just seeking their own experience and not paying attention to the effects on others, that is definitely moving into the arena of, or in the arena of poor ethical behavior. And that's where, you know, what the five precepts are trying to steer us away from. You know, anyone that's using any kind of intoxicants, whether it's, you know, it could be drugs and it could be alcohol, but it also could be, you know, sometimes people look at it in terms of other kinds of, it could be in being intoxicated with work or with coding or, you know, Netflix binging. It could be those kinds of graspings that separate and cause repercussions. So it's generally focused on things we take in, and that's, the suttas are particularly structured in that way. I mean, it's the precepts, but nonetheless, you can extrapolate out and see what you learn from that. And the Buddha was clear that in terms of the boundaries around sexual misconduct that he described, he really wasn't talking about the sexual act so much, but with whom one is doing it. So in Majjhima Nikaya 27, there's a list for lay people. He, two males, I guess, he does not have intercourse with girls under the protection of their mother or under the protection of their father, mother, father, brother, sister, relatives, or clan, or with women protected by law, with married women, or those already engaged. So there's a whole bunch of, you know, kind of reasonable, not young, no adultery, some of the same standards that we would probably have for what is ethical or not. But, you know, within our practice, just how we act energetically in terms of sexuality with others, it gets really subtle. You know, is flirting, is that a good thing? What is that? What is flirting? You know, are we teasing energy? We really got to pay attention to varying degree. You know, it gets subtler and subtler in ways in which we may check people out, whatever our gender is, whatever our preferences is, you know, to be mindful of to what degree we're turning towards people we may think are attractive in some ways just energetically versus others. And, you know, how we are, we really relating to people with kindness, or are we having some kind of little tingle of experience? So it gets, you know, it gets very subtle in how we nuance through all these things. And the whole thing about, you know, seeking experience is a good way to sift through it, because, you know, if you look at movies, a lot of, there's some, I don't watch these kind of movies anymore, but, you know, where someone's like kind of hit with some incredible passion, in love with someone, but it's kind of really more like in lust with someone or in desire with someone, and they go careening through some kind of plot where they're doing all kinds of super intense things to try to fulfill this desire or whatever it is, and it's pretty much about their experience. It's not really about the other person so much. It's not about, I would care for you if you suddenly were sick. It wouldn't be the same thing, you know. So it's really worth, I think this practice makes us look more and more at any way that we're really putting ourselves first and concretizing around ourselves and making anyone else an object. It keeps undoing that. And then, you know, it's a nebulous area, because sexuality can be one of the most beautiful human experiences we have for many of us. And some kinds of intoxicants, well, maybe so. What about, you know, native peyote ceremonies or psychedelics or ayahuasca? You know, people do stuff with that that's part of their path. I know a number of Buddhist people that have done ayahuasca stuff. I haven't. Back in the day, I did my share of acid, but that was before I was a practitioner. So it's not black and white, you know. It's not black and white. We have to really kind of keep checking on our inner light to see what choices we're making in those areas and what our intention is. And even, you know, sexual arrangements, there's all kinds of polyandry kind of stuff going on these days. And I don't know, You know, I mean, people do that. There's a town in what is it, Somerville, Massachusetts, is a center of people living in all kinds of polyamorous arrangements, which seem to work quite nicely, where people are kind to each other. So, you know, who are we to judge if they're kind to each other? That sounds good to me. So it does here in the West. We got to kind of broaden ourselves out while we're navigating through this, but it really gets down to the questions of intent. And is it kind and loving or not? And is it clinging or not? And how it kind of forces us almost, because we can't rely on the outer rules so much. We have to look inwardly at the energy of it while we're making our own micro choices around all these things. And God knows what'll be happening in the future. I mean, it's the, I don't know. You know, with AI and technology and God knows what these are real. I mean, there's synthetic drugs come, God knows. So it's hard to have a rigid boundary anywhere, but we have to really focus on our practice and you know, the journey to Nibbana. What's going to help that happen? And kindness and loving kindness to beings. But keep those in mind. We can figure this out. And you know, some things have changed so much in 2,600 years. I mean, especially attitudes, and you know, again, it's complicated in certain parts, like say here in Western Washington, attitudes about gay people and trans people and all that sort of thing are one way. In other parts of the country, they're another way, and the sexuality thing's all woven into that. So there's no rigid boundaries, but there is, you know, just touched on it. Just get into the heart. The suttas don't mention homosexuality except when they relate to monks. And it does say in the Vinaya, which is the rules of monastics, a monk who engages in sexual intercourse, whether with a woman, a man, or an animal, is no longer a monk. So they covered the bases there. And then, you know, this fourth area about what do we do about stuff that's enjoyable? It's not bad, but the area in it's all about, are we going to cling with it? And for those of you who study the 12 links of dependent origination, the sixth step is contact with a sense door, you know, coming in contact. The seventh is Vedanas. Is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? And let's assume it's pleasant. So then the next one would be craving, wanting it, and then clinging. And then we're stuck. You know, clinging is when we're rocking into suffering, and that drives the whole wheel around. So it's hard to navigate. Where do you know, where do you break that? You could have a pleasant, usually you have as contact, there's a pleasant Vedana, and then you don't go to craving. You cut it right there. Oh, pleasant, fine, mindful. Bring mindfulness to pleasant, and we don't go into craving and don't keep the wheel going. But that doesn't mean that pleasant things are bad. It just means don't get stuck. Dalai Lama happily eats ice cream, you know. Ice cream's fine, sex is fine. Just don't get stuck and don't hurt anybody. So it's kind of that whole area of how to be with something pleasant without pursuing something pleasant or making it the focus of our intentions or sliding into craving and then clinging without knowing it. So another way of navigating through this particularly subtle area, because you know, there's few things more intense than was it sex, drugs, and rock and roll? So the first two, you know, there's few things more intense than that. So how do we work with it? And how can we do it without clinging? And how can we do it without hurting people? What do we do or not do? What do we refrain from doing? And it just touches on the whole question of renunciation, you know, because in our sort of Judeo-Christian heritage, the idea of renunciation is you decide not to do things that you'd really want to do, like Lent or something, and make these boundaries and push those things off because they're, I don't know if they're sinful, but there's, it's not the proper thing to do. But in practice, renunciation is more like discerning what's going to be helpful or not. And then as practice, as we deepen on the path, things start to fall away. Things that you might have thought you really wanted to do just don't kind of matter anymore. So I often think of renunciation more like shedding as we grow, and there's freedom that comes out of that. So it's, you know, helpful. Like when I was in Thailand, I mean, I keep referring to Ajahn Ganha, but because his energy was so delightfully bright. It was just amazing, you know. And this is, you basically didn't have anything. He was a monk. He didn't have anything. And also Nisibo and Kovalo are like that here in, you know, Clear Mountain. It's this bright energy and they don't have anything. And there's renunciation is sort of due to their practice, the things that we might be attached to just sort of fell away. And it's sort of a running joke with a lot of people who've been practicing a long time, you know, like things I used to do, like sailing or something, they just kind of, so what? I don't care anymore. I really want to do the journey. You know, it really does change how we relate to a lot of sort of sensory-based experience things that many people put a huge amount of energy into conjuring up this experience, and then it kind of just doesn't seem to matter much anymore. There's something that really does matter is growth in a really tactile way and cultivating love, you know, loving kindness towards beings. So I think the very nebulousness of these two in a way is it's a good journey because it makes us do our work and makes us look into the underpinnings of choices we might make or not and how it's going to affect our journey on the path. So we got to really listen to ourselves. You got to listen to others. It gets pretty nuanced, but it's really powerful. And is insofar as we can do that, then it's really helpful for people because people are more confused about these two. I mean, the first three, most people kind of get it that you actually shouldn't steal. But the second, you know, where the boundaries of sexual misconduct are or aren't and how to navigate through intoxication in various ways is very confusing for people in the 21st century. And as much as we can, you know, practitioners, folks like this, can keep clarifying, it's helpful. It kind of, people kind of get it that there's some clarity there. And so it's a gift. It's really a gift. So we can, you know, sure, let's enjoy life, but not in a way that adds to clinging. Let's enjoy life, but not in a way that puts our enjoyment before someone else. And pay attention. You know, I got a long life, so twice during some big crises when my first marriage was falling apart, I went to some doctor and they prescribed some kind of, I don't know, antidepressants or something. And I think I took like one time. I was like, I don't think so. I could just feel this fuzzy thing happening. I just, nope, I'm out of here. You know, so pay attention. I mean, don't do what the man says. Do what your heart says. Do what the Dharma says. Choose, because it's a complicated world out there of all kinds of options coming at us from all kinds of perspectives, which aren't Dharma perspectives. So it takes some real preference setting. And I'm going to finish with a couple quotes in the Dhammapada. It says, if by surrendering a slight happiness, one may realize a great happiness, the wise person should give up the slight happiness, considering the greater one. So that's certainly a way to navigate this. And then the Buddha said, kind of the question here is, I think it's always good to emphasize that the Buddha really was talking about happiness. You know, he's talking about not clinging and freedom, but he's also talking about happiness. There's a number of places, a whole bunch of places in the suttas where there's happy monks. It's pretty cool. And here he says, in the Samyutta Nikaya 22.78, the simile of the lump of foam. But monks, the Tathagata, the Arhat, the perfectly enlightened one, having known as they really are the origin and passing away, the enjoyment, the danger and escape, in the case of forms, does not delight in forms is not delighted with forms, does not rejoice in forms. A way of saying he's just no longer caring about that stuff. With the change fading away and cessation of forms, a Tathagata dwells happily, having known, as they really are, the origin and passing away, the enjoyment, the danger, and the escape, in the case of sounds, in the case of odors, in the case of tastes, in the case of tactile objects, in the case of mental objects. The Tathagata does not delight in mental objects, is not delighted with mental objects, does not rejoice in mental objects. With the change fading away and cessation of mental objects, the Tathagata dwells happily. Let's sit for a moment.